Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Michael Bamberger, and I represent the appellants in 0935153. We would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, and we will split the first 17 minutes among us.
All right. Usually the clock there, you can watch your time. What usually happens is the first person keeps talking and the second person gets nervous.
So. No, she's she's going to tell me about it. The court below, contrary to all precedents, did what no court has ever done, which is to uphold a criminal restriction on the distribution to minors of non-obscene, sexually frank materials, which restriction does not incorporate the Miller-Ginsburg standards. The Miller standards were imposed by the Supreme Court in 73 because of the confusion created by and the difficulty of applying the earlier tests. As a result, the Supreme Court imposed 5 separate requirements, which incorporating Ginsburg to apply to minors are: 1, the material has to be taken as a whole; 2, it has to appeal to the prurient interest of minors; 3, it has to be patently offensive to prevailing standards in the adult community; 4, it has to apply contemporary community standards; and 5, it has to lack serious value for minors. The language of Miller is mandatory. On page 20 of 413 U.S., the Supreme Court says that it is defining the standard which must be used to identify obscene material that a state may regulate. And in summary, on page 24 of the opinion.
Well, you don't have to use that language if you have the gist of it incorporated in your statute, do you?
You don't have to use the language, but the 5 elements need to be charged to the jury, and the jury or the judge's trier of fact has to decide whether they are present. On page 24 of 413 U.S., the Supreme Court says the basic guidelines for the trier of fact must be the 5 requirements. And every court since then, whenever one of them is missing, has knocked out the statute. And the district court below found, as a matter of fact, that 4 of the 5 requirements are not present in the challenge statutes. And nevertheless, it found that the statutes are compliant with the First Amendment on the grounds that the statutes are functionally equivalent to Miller-Ginsburg in most or in many cases.
Could I just ask you about this to get concrete? Because, you know, everybody repeats these, and then the state repeats them, and they say that they're functionally equivalent. So kind of get down to the details. If you look at the second statute, the 057 statute, in your view, if the statute basically didn't have the part about arousing sexual desire, but it was simply that if somebody furnishes a minor with sexually explicit material and they do it for the purpose of inducing the minor to engage in sexual conduct, would that statute be subject to constitutional challenge?
To engage in sexual conduct with the person who is furnishing it. That is, but that's not the statute that would challenge it. That is a luring statute. That is an appropriate statute. That is a necessary statute because it says that you cannot use anything, including material that would otherwise be First Amendment protected, to lure someone into committing a crime or to lure someone in order to permit you to commit a crime. That's part, I think, B of...
That's where you basically provide the minor with some kind of sexually explicit material in order to induce them to engage in sex.
Right. And
you didn't challenge that at all.
I challenged
that. That was not challenged.
We don't challenge it. And
okay. So on that statute, okay, the problem with that statute, in your view, is the other problem?
The other half of the statute, A, which is the only part that we that we challenge of 057.
Okay. Now, is the difference between A and B essentially that, in the abstract sense, arousing sexual desire is not the same as engaging in sexual conduct?
Right. Arousing sexual desire is not a crime. I mean, the cases are abundant.
Well, it's not a crime except in this case. It is a crime.
No. I mean, separate from.
It's a crime under the Oregon statute.
Separate. If one uses a hot fudge sundae to induce someone to have someone, a child underage, to have sex with you, that's a crime. Separate and apart from the First Amendment. Causing a teenager to become sexually aroused other than in this First Amendment context is not a crime. I mean, were generally a crime, you would end up having maybe to ban bikinis and tight sweaters. But you know, and in fact, this court has said that the prurient interest requirement is not satisfied merely because materials arouse normal sexual responses, in a case called Ripplinger versus Collins, which is cited on page 20 of our brief. My time is about up, but what I think is important, no case has ever adopted the functional test. And by the way, as Ms. Runkles-Pearson will point out, it's not clear that this is true in this case in any event. And the Supreme Court has said, and all the cases have said, that you need to have as elements of the crime the various parts. Sometimes they talk three parts, sometimes they talk five, but it's of the Miller-Ginsburg test. Since I give the remaining of the front time to my colleague, and I'll be back.
All right.
May it please the Court. P.K. Runkles-Pearson, and I represent the plaintiffs ACLU, Cascade AIDS Project, Planned Parenthood, and Candace Morgan, a grandmother who is with us today. This would be a very different statute if it actually said what the state says that it says. It doesn't say that, and that's why we're here today, is that the construction of the statute that the district court imposed does great violence to the intent of the Oregon legislature, as exemplified in the plain text that it passed. If you turn to the statute itself and to the exceptions.
You're talking about which statute?
Which
now? 054 or 057?
Well, let's take 057. The exemptions are very much the same in both of them. Under 057, the exemption is in sub 2. And basically what the district court did is it took all of the language after the word sexual conduct, furnishes or uses an account of sexual conduct, struck out that language and inserted different language, which comes from dicta in a case called Maynard, which we addressed at great length in our briefs. They struck out that language and they inserted, instead of, forms merely an incidental part of an otherwise non-offending whole and serves some purpose other than titillation, they inserted, is not primarily intended to titillate the victim. Basically what this did, this interlineation, in other words, in effect, is it took out the first part of a two-part test that needs to be met in order for someone to be exempt.
Can I ask you about Maynard, just to make sure I understand the argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
In Maynard, the question, as I understood it, was which person is getting titillated, the victim or the perpetrator?
That's correct. That's one of the...
Maynard was trying to sort out that we're talking about.
Yes, that's...
Thomas is an aside, wasn't it?
It was. It was. And that's the language that the court was trying to interpret in order to follow the Oregon constitutional test, which asks them to look at whether the statute is directed at harmful effects. So they were trying to figure out whether the harmful effects were the titillation of the minor or the titillation of the perpetrator.
And in the end, that doesn't really figure into the interpretation here.
Not at all. And in fact, if you look at what Maynard actually did, they went on to find the statute overbroad under the Oregon Constitution, and they explicitly said that they weren't addressing either a vagueness challenge or a First Amendment challenge.
Let me just ask you one sort of side question. On this construction of the statute, which the state offers and which the district court somewhat adopted, is that something we should be concerned about by certifying those questions to the Oregon Supreme Court? I mean, is that anything we should even contemplate?
It's a possibility, but I don't think that's necessary here. I think that
why not?
Because the Oregon statutory interpretation is very clear. Even in the Maynard test, the Maynard case itself, they talked about the fact that you should look at the text first before anything else. Now, what Mr. Casper for the state is going to tell you, and he's right, is that cases interpreting the text of a statute fall under that first level of scrutiny under the Oregon Constitution. That's true. But when you look at Maynard, it doesn't actually do any of that. It's simply talking about a completely different question. So if you follow what the Oregon Constitution has, or the Oregon statutory interpretation scheme has asked you to do, which is to look at the text, then you don't need to ask anybody else about that. And in fact, that's exactly what the federal
court did. You don't think this, as your response would be, from what I've been reading in the cases, is that the state's interpretation is not one that is reasonable.
No, it's not reasonable.
Reasonably susceptible as written, because the legislature had something different in mind.
No, and it's not binding because they're not talking about anything else. And in fact, if you look further at Maynard, to go back to Judge McEwen's question, the issue that they were looking at was what did the legislature intend in doing, not whether they actually did it or not. And that's why they actually struck down the statute as overbroad further on, for reasons that aren't germane here. But they were looking at what was the legislature intending to do. And we agree with Mr. Casper. When the legislature was trying to pass this statute, they were trying to get at evil, perverted people who were giving sexual materials to minors for the purpose of getting them to have sex with them. And we think that that's a bad thing. It shouldn't happen, of course. But that's not the issue.
Go to Section 2, which the district court modified in order to save it from constitutional challenge. Leaving aside how the district court treated it, can you give us your analysis of what's wrong with this subsection 2?
Certainly. And I could certainly tell you that in particular this is a problem for two of my clients, the Cascade AIDS Project and Planned Parenthood, and Ms. Morgan, who are trying to give sexual education materials to people. If you look at it, it's a two-part exception. You have to meet both parts of this exception in order to not be susceptible to liability under the statute. The first is that it forms merely an incidental part of an otherwise non-offending whole. Part of the problem with that is the vagueness challenge that we've brought up. We don't know what's incidental. For example, if you take one of the sex ed books at issue in this case, it's perfectly normal. It has some discussion of the matter that would be deemed sexually explicit here, intercourse, things like that. There are pictures, so it would also fall under Section 054. But we don't know whether or not a district attorney prosecuting this or anyone would see that as incidental or not. Is it incidental because of how much there is or how important it is? We don't know, and we think that that's a problem. The second part is serve some purpose other than titillation.
What about the first part, though? It says of an otherwise non-offending whole. Does one have to determine what in the world is a otherwise non-offending whole?
We don't know what that means either.
If there's pictures on page 100, and that's what you're prosecuted for, and there are other pictures on page 50, do the pictures on 100 form a part of an otherwise non-offending whole? since page 50 might be offensive, too?
I think that's a good point. We don't know. And neither do we know whether or not they're incidental.
That kind of ties into the purpose argument, too, doesn't it? Who in the world knows what purpose is? Is that right?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I guess the argument part of you on purpose would be the same sort of argument. Who knows what purpose is?
Well, I think that the purpose of the material, I think that that's part of another vagueness issue that we have here, is that
purpose, if we had something that everybody agreed was hardcore porn, I don't think we'd have trouble saying that it has a purpose related to titillation.
Well, certainly, but the issue here, Your Honor, is not whether hardcore porn falls under this, of course.
I'm asking you here, in that case, we can understand what the word purpose means. Why is this different when it's purpose other than titillation?
Right.
Why is it different than the hardcore porn example?
Well, the hardcore porn example, I think we could all agree that the purpose of that is titillation. Only titillation, likely. If it was something other than titillation, then it wouldn't fall under this. And in addition,
when we say hardcore porn, are we talking about obscenity?
Well, I think that's another problem.
Are we talking about something else? Because I gather that porn is okay, even if it's hardish core porn. I gather that that's not excluded from First Amendment protection. Am I right or wrong?
Well, in Miller and Ginsburg, when you're talking about children, you have to talk about what would be have serious value for minors. And
right.
It's likely that hardcore porn would not.
Okay.
So that would be an issue. My time is running out. I want to make sure I've answered all your questions.
We're going to let you continue to answer our questions, so we're not trying to cut you off.
Did you have any further questions about the statute?
I just want to try to understand the difference in the two categories of plaintiffs here, sort of the booksellers, and you would be education and service providers, more or less, plus a grandma or a non-guardian family member, I guess, would be. And if we were to accept your as-applied challenge, what would that order say? I mean, how would that be framed in terms of the relief that you seek from the court on your as-applied challenge?
Well, I think it would require by its very nature for you to look individually at each plaintiff or to ask the district court to do so, which is one problem that we had with the district court opinion, that they summarily rejected the as-applied challenge.
What would the district court look at? Would it look at the material they're selling, or would it look at what they do? Or?
I think the district court can look at the evidence we submitted. In this case already, we submitted affidavits from each and every plaintiff together with lists of materials that they use or intend to give or are giving or would like to give to minors or preteens, and we've actually provided copies of those books.
Well, I mean, Powell's Books has more, I'm sure, than what's listed in your material. Is that correct?
I'm sure they do, yes. And we've submitted a list of books as well. So I think that if the court could decide on the basis of what's in the record alone, that would be sufficient to decide the as-applied challenge.
For your clients, it's a different approach than Powell's Books, it would seem to me.
That's correct.
Because you have a directed function with related materials. Is that right?
That's right.
It's difficult for me to see how an as-applied challenge is especially helpful or works in this particular case. As the district judge said, you know, practically everybody in Oregon who cares about speech is here in front of us me today. How in the world am I supposed to do an as-applied challenge? You want me to pick out three books and say, okay, those books are good, and then wait for you to come at me? When you're being prosecuted for something, as-applied makes an awful lot of sense. When there's the statement that you shouldn't be selling Fannie Hill, now it makes sense. How does it make sense when what you're talking about is a great, broad, generic category of everything you do, practically?
Well, I assure you there are a great many people who care about speech who aren't here in front of you today, Your Honor, in the state of Oregon. But I think that the very easy way to do it is to look directly at the materials that we've submitted. And, of course, we believe that when you add up all of those as-applied challenges together, what you get is substantial overbreadth. That's really the easiest way for this Court to resolve the dispute, and we think that it's the best way. The very fact that you have so many people in front of you who have so many different interests and the statute would apply to all of them should tell you something. And we think that that means that the easiest way to resolve this is substantial overbreadth. But there is a way to answer your question, Judge Fernandez, there is a way to answer an as-applied challenge. It would require looking at the specific evidence presented, which we presented lists of books. The Court could decide on those lists of books, and this Court wouldn't have to do it. It could be done on remand.
And saying, that list is a nice list, and then if you ever add another book, you can be prosecuted for that? Is that what you're saying?
But at least well, in theory, you could be presented as you could be prosecuted for it, but we would at least have some assurance that books of this type are protected, and that would make it much easier to defend a challenge.
You basically have a serial litigation.
Yes, and of course we prefer not to resolve it that way, but it could be done. If you have no more questions, I hope that you will allow us to have some time on rebuttal.
Rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If need be, we'll also give the State some additional time.
May it please the Court, Counsel Michael Casper, on behalf of the State of Oregon and the Attorney General. Let me start by saying that I believe that plaintiffs are mischaracterizing Maynard and what the Court said in that case. That case is not about simply who was being titillated. That case is a question of whether the law that fits into Category 1 under Oregon's constitutional analysis, which is to say a statute that is directed at the content of speech, or whether it fits into and which is per se unconstitutional, unless it fits into a historical exception, but that's by the by here, or it fits into Category 2, which is a law that is aimed at the effects of speech. And in 1996, two cases had come to the Court of Appeals. One of them was State versus Stoneman, which was a child pornography case. And the other was Maynard, which was a case about furnishing pornography to minors. In both cases, the Court of Appeals looked at the Supreme Court's earlier case law and said, these statutes are aimed at on their face, they're aimed at the content of speech. So while we may like the idea of regulating child pornography, you can't do it in Oregon under Oregon's constitutional analysis. Stoneman went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, well, wait. We're willing to say for a very narrow category of statutes in which the speech itself is necessarily harmful, child pornography in that case, that although it is on its face directed at speech, it is in fact directed at the harms that are occasioned by that speech, but only when the harm necessarily is coextensive with the speech. That was the guidance that Stoneman gave. Maynard came up on appeal, and the Supreme Court remanded and said, Court of Appeals, look back at your conclusion that the furnishing pornography to a minor is a Category 1 law in light of Stoneman. So armed with that, what happened in Maynard is the Court of Appeals looked at this furnishing pornography to a minor statute and said, well, let's look carefully at the language of this particular exception. Well, first of all, two things. Oregon's statute then, as now, includes a specifically enumerated and fairly graphic list of things that if they are depicted or described, constitute pornography. That requirement is one that exists under federal law for adult obscenity. It certainly doesn't exist for child obscenity. In addition, the statute at issue in Maynard included this exception that it excluded materials that where the sexually explicit parts were merely an incidental part of an otherwise non-offending whole and serving some purpose other than titillation.
Thought it had another word in there, the word therein.
Therein, excuse me. And it's a...
Well, therein might make a difference.
Therein.
You're right.
Therein might make a difference, might it not?
I think it's relevant, and I didn't mean to exclude it. So the court looked at that entire exception and they said, we have no trouble seeing that this statute, the goal of the statute is to regulate the effect, to regulate the effects or to prevent the effects, the harmful effects of hardcore pornography, and that it is aimed at materials that are primarily intended to sexually arouse. The state's position is that what the court was doing there was interpreting the exception in toto, that that's their gloss, as it were. That's their interpretation of what that statute does. So, however, the statute was overbroad because of a kind of a bizarre drafting error, which was that the statute applied to furnishing materials to a minor, but the exception applied only to selling materials to a minor, but not loaning materials to a minor. So there was a fairly significant number of categories in which it didn't apply. Maynard basically gave a roadmap to the legislature, saying, here's how you can fix this. You can make the exception apply in all cases. Because, and they say this in the opinion, the exception applies for an R-rated movie, a mainstream movie, if you're selling it, but not if you're renting it. We need this to apply only to hardcore porn, so here's the roadmap, legislature. Fix it, and you'll be regulating only materials that are sexually explicit because they fit this enumerated list and they are primarily intended to sexually arouse.
Excuse me, did you say that these statutes apply only to hardcore porn? Is that your position?
That is our position. The current statutes, so our
it doesn't use the word hardcore porn.
It does not. But what
and if it's supposed to say that, why doesn't it?
I believe the reason it doesn't say that is because what the legislature has tried to do here is to furnish an objective description of hardcore porn.
Well, it's not.
Where do they say that?
As to 057, is it? Where is the tie into the definition of hardcore porn? It just said it's material whose purpose. Serves some purpose other than titillation. I dare say that an awful lot of writing serves, good writing, I mean, classic writing, serves very little purpose when it goes into description other than titillation.
Well, again, our position is that guided by the Court of Appeals decision in Maynard, the legislator adopted this exception for materials that were where the sexually explicit parts were only an incidental part of a non-offending whole.
Let's just back up a minute.
Okay.
Go back to where we kind of started before. You also asked Judge Fernandez's question. You said, well, this statute applies only to hardcore porn. Okay, take that as a given. How do I know that? Where do I look in the statute so I could say, you're right, I understand exactly what you're saying?
You know that by interpreting the statute using the rules of Oregon statutory interpretation, which is to say, look at the text in context and the legislative history. The legislative history includes the Maynard case, and we've cited the legislative history in our brief. What the statute says is it expressly enumerates sexual acts, sex between a person and an animal, et cetera, et cetera, and only where those things are not an incidental part of an otherwise not offending whole.
So if I'm looking at the definition of sexually explicit material, that could be basically intercourse, correct?
I'm sorry?
That could be intercourse.
Yes.
Genital to genital.
Right. But only in materials that are primarily intended to sexually arouse.
So that is hardcore porn?
It's hardcore porn if it's a material that is whose primary intention of which is to sexually arouse, and it can say
primary intention. Here's what the statute says. It talks about
that
incidental, otherwise non-offending whole serves some purpose other than titillation. So where do you get primarily intended to arouse?
That's the interpretation that a state court has given that exclusion.
Well, you know, here's the difficulty with I don't too much care what the state court has said at this moment. Here's the difficulty, Stephen, and I sort of alluded to a little bit before. If you go back and you read novels out of the 19th century and early 20th century, they conveyed the notion that two people were going to have sex, but they didn't describe it, ever. It's like the old movies. You'd see two people walking hand in hand toward the bedroom, and then there'd be a blackout. And everybody knew they're going there to have sex. Now that advances the storyline. They're going to have sex. If you read modern novels, more modern novels, you get great descriptions, even of good authors. You know, look at Byatt, look at John Irving, look at almost any good modern novelist. You will find they don't just go into the bedroom and we imply they're having sex. We get a nice description of exactly what goes on. Now, that's fine. That doesn't distress me a bit. But how, if a prosecutor says, you know what? The only purpose of that description was to titillate, or the primary purpose of the description was to titillate because you could have done beautifully well without doing any description at all. Why did you put it in?
Okay, there's some really important points here. It's the primary purpose of the material as a whole. It has to be...
That's not what it says.
That's not what it says.
It doesn't say the material as a whole.
Mm-mm.
What material?
That is how the Court of Appeals read it, and that is what...
What material are we talking about? The whole book?
It's
a book.
Right.
The whole book?
The exception says that it's not an incidental part.
It doesn't say.
Of an otherwise non-offending whole and serving some purpose other than titillation damage.
The material we're talking about, is
well,
part
I mean,
of a
non- that is the
moment.
Okay, let me.
Wait a second, please.
Wait for the question.
Sorry.
The material we're talking about is part of a non-offending whole, and the non-offending whole serves some other purpose? Of course it does, because it's non-offending. And the material we're talking about serves some of that purpose?
What the Court of Appeals expressly said is that that exclusion applies to materials that are not primarily intended to titillate the victim. So not the parts inside them, but the material taken as a whole is not primarily intended to titillate the victim. And that's our position about what the legislature relied on that. But if I can, I want to take a step back because there are two statutes here. And in 054, which is now furnishing a minor, it applies only to kids who are 12 and younger. It applies only to an express set of sexually explicit acts and only materials that are primarily intended to sexually arouse. On a facial challenge, plaintiff's burden is to show that it applies only to images, too, excuse me. So it doesn't apply to any of the novels or whatever. It only applies to images.
I thought we were talking about 057.
Right now I'm talking about 054.
Oh, we switch. Okay, fine. 054.
That was what I meant.
What about material?
I'm sorry.
054.
054 talks about material.
Right, but it applies the
but it's only pictures.
The 054... applies only to images. And I'm trying to find, right now I'm pausing because I'm trying to find the part of
furnishing it's sexually explicit material to a child. If the person intentionally.
Right, and if you look at the definition of sexually explicit material means material containing visual images of human masturbation, sexual intercourse, genital.
So this would be books with pictures, or pictures.
Pictures of people having sex, where the material book as a whole is primarily intended to sexually arouse. That is what the legislature intended. They manifestly did. I mean, the interpretation that plaintiffs are giving it is manifestly unconstitutional, not just under the First Amendment, but obviously under Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution.
Oregon. Legislative reading is a little different, it seems, from some other folks, like federal legislative reading. And I've been trying to understand it. If a statute says nobody shall carry a sign on a public sidewalk, that's what it says. It shall be a crime to carry a sign on a public sidewalk. And I go back into the legislative history, and the legislative history says, you know what, we don't think people should carry hate signs on public sidewalks, and so we're going to pass this statute. When a court reads that in Oregon, is the court supposed to say, even though the sign prohibits all, the statute prohibits all signs, it only applies to hate signs? Is that how we're supposed to read things?
You're supposed to be ascertaining the intent of the legislature. If it does violence to the language, what the most recent case on Oregon statutory interpretation, which I would direct the court to, is State versus Gaines. And what it says is that the pole star here is the legislator's intent. What did they intend to do? What did they intend to mean? And I mean, that's taken rather literally. What was in the legislature's mind at the time?
Okay, so we've got two senators on my example, or in this one.
Right.
Two state legislatures say, here's what we intend. And then that's good enough.
Well, state versus Gaines, and I think I'm sorry.
The statute's passed, and then you uphold it? Because that's what two legislators said?
There is a rule that it has to be, the text has to be able to carry the burden of the, it has to be not a wholly implausible reading of the text.
In my example, does the text carry the burden?
I think in your example, it probably does not.
Okay.
In your understanding of 054, how does the exception fit in?
Well, it's an exception to liability in the first instance. So what
let me put it this way. In your view, is the exception even necessary, given your understanding of 054?
Yeah, absolutely. The exception, the exception limits the category of speech to those materials that are primarily intended to sexually arouse.
And then explain to me again what your understanding of 054 is, or does.
What it does is applies to materials that have visual images of people having sex, et cetera, et cetera, and only those materials that are primarily intended to arouse, and applies only to furnishing to kids 12 and younger.
And we would construe the exception 054 the same way as you just articulated with respect to the exception in 057.
That's correct.
But we'd have to rewrite it.
I don't understand why you were saying we have to rewrite it. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean,
the words what you just said don't have any relationship to what the statute says.
Our position is that primarily intended to sexually arouse is a fair reading of the. Is it not a wholly implausible reading of the exception?
You know, that kind of goes back maybe to the first point made. It's not wholly implausible, but that's kind of not the rule that we have. We have this Miller-Ginsburg, for better or for worse, that we've all been living under for many years. And one of the challenges made to the Oregon statute is it doesn't even follow the basic framework, you know, down to the child's purient interest and appeal to the child and all of the other things. What is your response to that?
Well, the reason it doesn't is because under Oregon law, the Miller test is itself censorship. In State versus Henry, the Oregon Supreme Court said the problem with the Miller test, or the Miller-Ginsburg test for that matter, is it asks the state to look at the value. Does this have serious value, or is this appeal to the purient interest? And those are subjective determinations that the state has no business making. So the only thing that we can regulate, we cannot regulate on the basis of whether something does or does not have value. We can only regulate on the basis of whether something harms somebody. And so what the legislature is endeavoring to do here is to isolate a category of speech that is necessarily harmful to kids. And the way they did that is by attempting to describe hardcore pornography. If I could, because I'm getting low on time, I want to get to 057, and I haven't done that at all yet.
We were just...
Okay, is that okay? There are two prongs, and we don't understand, the plaintiffs are not challenging speech which is intended to actually get a kid to engage in sex. The legislature's purpose in sub A is to prohibit using hardcore pornography to arouse a child or the person. The paradigmatic sort of situation that is envisioned by the legislature here is where somebody like a camp counselor or somebody is in a room with a kid showing them pornography, trying to get them off, or on the internet sending them pornography on the internet, trying to arouse them. To the extent that it isolates hardcore pornography and that those things are psychologically damaging to kids, our position is that act is a form of sexual abuse in and of itself. It does not apply to...
You say it only reaches hardcore pornography, but there are things that show sexual arousal that are short of hardcore pornography, right?
Yes.
Okay, how does that fit in your statute?
Well, because the statute only applies, again, up front. It begins by limiting the materials to which it applies.
Hardcore porn.
Where does the statute do that?
It says
hardcore.
It says sexually explicit material, right?
Correct.
Where does it do that? It doesn't incorporate that other definition here, does it?
It does. It incorporates a similar definition. It's slightly broader. It doesn't. Whereas 054, and this is a fairly relevant point, is that whereas 054 applies only to images, 057's definition applies also to narrative descriptions.
And where's that definition?
You
took us to a statute that describes certain kinds of sexual activity, and 057 does the same thing?
Correct. And it's 167.051, I believe.
Okay.
Right, but I'm just having trouble understanding this, so I'm going to take some time to make sure I understand it.
Okay.
051 has the definition of sexually explicit material?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Correct. And that's where I go, that is hardcore porn?
Coupled with the definite... It's hardcore porn when you couple it with the exception for materials that are where the explicit parts are merely an incidental part of an otherwise non-offending.
So let me just get it straight. If I take sexually explicit material, which basically is different forms of sex.
Yes, explicitly described. Yes.
Well, they're not all that unusual. They're just different forms, okay? So they are laid out there in the statute. So I have to take that, and then I have to add it to being primarily to arouse?
Correct. That, and in 054, it's sub 2. It's the exception that we've been talking about through.
Sexually explicit material that's primarily to arouse, that then transforms itself, in terms of what you're trying to get at, in your view, to hardcore pornography.
Correct. And what I guess I would say is it's incumbent upon plaintiffs to show materials that meet that definition. In other words, a substantial number of materials that meet that definition that would be regulable under Oregon law. And to date, they haven't come up with any. I mean, none of the sexual education materials, if we're correct about our interpretation of the law, and I think that they would concede this, that none of the materials...
If you're not correct in your interpretation of the law, are the statutes invalid?
Well, it depends on who is correct.
Your whole argument seems to turn on the fact that we need to read in Maynard.
Well, it's not just Maynard. I want to be clear that...
Let's start with Maynard. I mean, is reading in Maynard essential to your argument?
It's not essential. It's very important, but it's not essential. But the key thing is to use Oregon's legislative interpretation.
How do people get charged with one of these things, or one of these people out here gets charged with the statute? What's the jury instruction? I mean, what's the law that the actual judge uses to say, okay, I'm not going to instruct the jury that you have violated 054 if what?
Well, I mean, you could use the words of the statute.
Well, we have a jury instruction, and Oregon has a jury instruction.
You could use the words of the statute, and then the jury would say, well, okay, I'm going to get this. Am I supposed to be, is it incidental to the whole work, or is it incidental to the bad part?
Mm-hmm.
That's what the jury would wonder, right? So basically, just to get this, to get your position, if this went to trial under Oregon law, as in most states, of course, recitation of the statute usually is a pretty good jury instruction. That's what we would tell the jury.
We'd be very happy if we told the jury that it had to, the material as a whole had to be primarily intended to sexually arouse the viewer. That is the definition that the state takes, and we believe that none of the materials that and the district court found this also, that none of the materials the plaintiffs have come up with so far meet that definition, let alone a substantial number.
So we sort of have to throw this, stuff the statute in the teapot and create a non-statutory
I don't think
create a non-statutory statement that says, never mind about non-offending as a whole, never mind about serves a purpose other than titillation, we're just going to tell you it means that little short sentence you just told me, right?
What I'm saying is that's what the state court has said it means,
okay.
And that's what the legislature, relying on what the state court said it means, intended. You may say, well, what the
it
state...
It would have been easier if they had written down what they intended.
You may say the state court is unreasonable. That's not a reasonable reading of that exclusion. And the legislature was irresponsible for relying on an unreasonable...
One of the problem is that legislature didn't take the words and then write those in. I'm having trouble understanding, the state of Oregon. We got the court telling you what this should mean, and now we have the legislature doesn't really follow that.
Well, the legislature relied on the Oregon courts had said this here's a roadmap, use this language, you're okay, and they did. And I don't know that they expected a federal court to come in later and say, forget about what your state court told you. That doesn't mean what they said. And so they relied on the state court's interpretation. And this language it's been in the statute since the early 70s. So it's not like it's brand new.
To your knowledge, has there ever been a prosecution under this statute? These two.
I do know, and if it's not in the record, but I'd be happy to tell you if you like.
Just curious.
There have been many prosecutions under
054.
057. 054 is rarely used.
The B part or the A part?
Both. It's generally charged under both A and B. And I have examples talking to DAs about the kinds of cases in which they are charging these things.
The jury instruction that's available under Oregon law is pretty straightforward, as Judge McEwen was suggesting. It doesn't have any of this language that you've just been arguing that should be read into it.
Well, I wish it did, and I would certainly advocate that the jury instruction.
Well, the judges who make up or whoever forms these the committees that promulgate these jury instructions don't read Maynard or
but,
the argument you make into these jury instructions.
Well, our argument is not trust us, we're not going to prosecute under it.
I understand.
Our argument is that this is what it means under state law, and if you apply the state versus Gaines analysis, this is the result that you. I understand it's not the federal analysis. It's very, very different. But if you apply the state law interpretive analysis of state versus Gaines, that's what the statute means.
So all the books that we have in our office, from Judy Bloom to whatever, in your view, they would all pass muster under the statute?
Absolutely. In our view, they come nowhere close to being something that the Oregon wants to regulate.
Okay. Well, we intruded on your good nature, so you have 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Let me just quickly raise a couple of points, and then Ms. Runkles-Pearson will as well. Number one, it's very nice to say that Oregon believes it just covers hardcore pornography. The court below found that the statute covers romance novels. It covers, in fact, the judge read one from cover to cover. He said it would be his first and his last. Joy of sex, and children's books like How Sex Works, it's perfectly normal, and so on. So there's a real disconnect here. Also, what's most important of the lack of the Miller test, and I think the entire test is important, but what's most important is lacking serious value. There are many books, motion pictures.
To his argument that, you know, that actually would make an inclusion on Oregon's constitution.
Well, the answer is you can have both. You can say Oregon, we're going to have. I believe you are required. You're dealing with two constitutions. You have to comply with the U.S. Constitution, and you have to comply with the Oregon Constitution. And the way to do so is to have whatever statute Oregon believes is appropriate under its statute, and then say, provided, however, that it's also got to meet this test.
Well, but, you know, it's very common, particularly in the West, to have state constitutions that are far more protective on privacy, First Amendment, and other things than the U.S. Constitution. So how do you reconcile
that? The Oregon, I'm saying if they want, to the extent that they're more protective, they may be, but for example, with respect to works having serious value, the federal constitution is more protective. And in fact, the federal case is a case called Hudnut versus American Booksellers, or American Booksellers versus Hudnut, depending on what level, which went up to the Supreme Court, said that you can't look at harm, that's not an appropriate federal statute. And I apologize, I have a copy of the...
We let your co-counsel have some time.
Pardon me?
We'll let your co-counsel have some time.
Okay. But one last final
one.
Point. Really one?
One sentence.
One sentence.
That was it? Thank you.
The Pope case.
I'm looking at co-counsel now. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to point out a few things about Maynard and about State versus Gaines that I think are pretty important based on what came out of Mr. Casper's discussion with you. First of all, when you look at Maynard, and I encourage you to read it very thoroughly, as I have many times throughout the course of this, what Maynard is doing is it's trying to determine what the legislature wanted to do. What did the legislature want to do when they enacted the statute? Did they intend to direct it at content, or did they intend to direct it at harmful effects? And what the court decided in Maynard is that what the legislature wanted to do, as Mr. Casper says, was direct it towards hardcore pornography. The problem is that's not what they did. And when you look at the text of the statute, that's not what it says. And that brings us to State versus Gaines, which Mr. Casper has characterized as being something that's solely directed or primarily directed towards the legislature's intent. Throughout all of its Oregon statutory interpretation, the ultimate goal is to determine what the legislature intends. But what Gaines says and what PGE versus Boley says, which is the other primary Oregon case regarding statutory interpretation, is that the text is the touchstone of everything. You can't take something that the legislature intended to do and import it into the text if the text doesn't support it or if the text doesn't say it. And that's exactly the same thing as what the United States Supreme Court did in its recent decision in Stevens, in United States versus Stevens. The prosecution said, that's not what this animal cruelty statute means to us. And the court said, we're not going to import into the text something that it won't bear. That's exactly what's going on here, and that's why we think it's so egregious. They're doing great violence to the text and the language of the statute.
I thought we read that after PGE, the legislature passed some other, or Constitution passed some other interesting law that says, no, you can't read the text. You've got to mix our stuff back into the text.
Yes, I can explain that. PGE versus Boley set up a very rigid system where you had to look at the text first, and then only if you found an ambiguity could you even peek at the legislative history. Then the legislature passed a statute that said you can look at the legislative history for what it's worth anytime you want. And State versus Gaines said, well, look at it whenever we want, for whatever it's worth. But the text is still the most important thing. And I think you'll find if you go back and look at Gaines, that's exactly what it says. So even though we don't have these rigid rules, we can take a peek. But if it doesn't say something very plainly, and if it doesn't say something that's supported by the text, we're still not going to import that meaning. And that's what the state wants you to do here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank all counsel for your arguments. Very interesting case. The case just argued of Powell's Books v. Shirtcliffe is submitted, and we're adjourned for the morning.